And of course, you all know that in a standard model, the weak interactions are purely left-handed. And you might think of that, okay, that's the way it is, but still, we do not have an explanation of why this is the case. So maybe this is just kind of a low energy prescription of a left-right symmetric theory further up at some high energy scale, which is then spontaneously broken somewhere, maybe even in the TEV range, such that only our low energy world looks left-handed. So, more physics-wise, left-right models allow to restore parity at some high energy scale. Not necessarily the TEV scale or any scale that we can reach at current or near future collider experiments, but at least somewhere. Second, the nice feature about left-right models is that they are naturally anomaly free without having to introduce some extra fermion content in order to cancel anomalies. Then they emerge kind of naturally from SO10 grand unified models by just decomposing the gauge group accordingly. So you do have this extra SU2R factor in there. And finally, more from a phenomenological side. If you look at the recent CMS W prime searches, so they look at events in muon plus missing energy. And what they do find is that, well, okay, so what you find is that their measurement agrees pretty well with the standard model background, but what you have up here is this one outlier event with a transverse mass of 2.4 TeV that is way above the background. Of course, it's only one event, but maybe this hints to some kind of new charged gauge bosons. But if you do not find that very convincing, I must say I'm not too convinced either. And so the main motivation for our study was actually something different, which is, at least amongst flavor physicists, known as the VUB problem. So I guess you all know the CKM matrix, which is this 3x3 matrix describing flavor violation and charged current interactions in the standard model. And you can determine the elements of the CKM matrix, and more specifically now, this element VUB, by measuring tree-level decays from a meson that contains a B quark to some final state which contains a U quark. Or if you look at the decay of the charged B, which is B and U bar, then you also directly access this element VUB. And when you do these measurements, you can extract the values of VUB that you obtain from this several modes. And what you see here is that the numbers you obtain for VUB are not quite the same. So they are consistent at something like the 2 sigma level. It's not like a huge inconsistency, but still, it would certainly be nice if you could find some explanation of why these numbers are kind of different. And in fact,
but the exclusive models require
yes. Yeah, the exclusive mode. So the form factor is obtained from lattice QCD, usually. Yeah. I think both, isn't it? Maybe not. Yeah.
For B, can you get it from every part of the picture?
No, it's not enough, just
Oh, no, sorry, you're talking about the form factor.
Yeah, you need a
that's
B
a
to
long
pi transitional form factor. And given that we have very little success with the transitional form factor for pi zero,
Yeah, certainly. But even if you do not trust the B to pi decay mode too much, you still have the discrepancy between the inclusive mode and the B to tau nu decay.
Oh, that's
And
for sure.
those are much cleaner. Okay, so anyway, this is the situation in the standard model. But once you add some right-handed charged currents to your theory, the predictions, so the measurements changes because you do not just access the element of the CKM matrix, which describes the left-handed charged current interactions, but you also have a similar matrix describing right-handed charged current interactions. And then just schematically, if you look at how these right-handed currents enter the different measurements, you see that for this B to pi mode, it's basically a constructive interference. For the B to tau mu mode, it's a destructive interference because that mode is sensitive to the axial current. And finally, for the inclusive mode, you do not have an interference term, and they just add in squares. So once you have some new charged gauge boson, some right-handed W, it will always mix because of electric symmetry breaking with the standard model W. Yeah. So in the end, it ends up being an effective. Exactly, it's a right-handed coupling of your standard model W that gives the effect. Okay, and if you look at this situation more pictorially, you see, so on the y-axis, this is the size of the right-handed currents. So up here for zero, it's just a standard model situation, and you see that the arrow bands do not quite overlap from these different measurements. But once you go to a non-vanishing size of right-handed currents, you see that all these three bands nicely overlap, and you can get a very good fit for your different VUB determinations. Okay, so in words, these right-handed charged currents affect the decays that that determine the VUB measurements in a different manner, and therefore, in principle, they allow for an elegant solution to the VUB problem. However, just at this stage, it's only an effective field theory approach because in practice, you always have to consider constraints on different flavor observables that you cannot do until you have a concrete model. So the question we ask is, does this solution to the VUB problem actually hold in a concrete left-right model? And by concrete left-right model, I will try to look at a rather minimalistic model, i.e. not to include too many extra symmetries, extra particle content in order to make it consistent, but just use what we need to have in order to have a consistent theory. Okay, so what's on the menu today? We are now ready to start with the appetizer, the hors d'oeuvre, which is a brief description of the left-right model I'm going to consider. Afterwards, I'll serve you the soup, which is an overlook on the collider and electroweak position constraints on the model. And finally, the main dish will be the discussion of flavor constraints on the left-right models we are considering. And in particular, I will try to identify some patterns in the left-right flavor sector. And as dessert, I will summarize the results. So here's the staff that's providing this meal for you. And we can go for the appetizer. So the basic ingredients for the left-right model, first of all, is, of course, a left-right symmetric flavor group. So we extend the usual standard model gauge group by this additional factor, SU2R. And then it turns out that this U1 factor that you need in order to get the standard model hypercharges and everything is just the U1 B minus L. So the fermion representations are then implemented quite straightforwardly. The left-handed quarks and leptons are doublet under the SU2L, and the right-handed quarks and leptons are doublets under SU2R. And with this setup, you realize that the electric charge is simply given by left-handed isospin plus right-handed isospin plus B minus L divided by 2. And this right-handed isospin plus B minus L over 2 is kind of a natural origin of the standard model hypercharges, which look like pretty random in the standard model. Okay, so then once you have extended your symmetry, you of course have to break it somehow in order to see what we have seen so far in all experiments. So we need to extend the Higgs sector with respect to the standard model. And in the version I'm considering here, which is one of the most simple versions, you have you have this bidoublet representation for the Higgs, and then you have two extra states, which are these delta L and delta R, which are triplets under the SU2R and SU2L, respectively. And in fact, from now on, we do not really need this delta L anymore, because so the delta R is introduced to break SU2R in order to the standard model gauge group, so that we do not have this extra factor anymore. The delta L is introduced only so that you have a parity symmetric particle content in your model so that you can in principle, restore parity at some high energy scale. Okay, so how does the symmetry breaking work? Well, the delta R gets some VEF at some TeV-ish scale, which we so it could be in principle much higher, but we want to be at TeV-ish in order to see something. That VEF breaks the SU2R times U1B minus L to the hypercharge gauge group. And then in a second step, the bidoublet field phi gets a VEF that breaks the usual standard model SU2L times U1Y to U1Q. And what is interesting to note here is that instead of like only one VEF in the standard model of your Higgs field, you now have two VEFs in this field phi, which we parameterize as C times V and S times V, where V is just the usual electric symmetry breaking VEF, and C and S are just two parameters, which add up like C squared plus S squared equal 1. And finally, note that in order to be consistent with the data that we have already, the ratio of the VEF V divided by kappa R has to be much smaller than 1, and I'm going to call it epsilon for referring to a small quantity. So from this picture, you get some new heavy gauge bosons, which I call W prime and Z prime, which have something like TeV scale masses once you assume that right-handed VEF at the TeV scale. And also note that the Z prime is much heavier than the W prime. There's at least a factor of 2 between the two of them. And also, because of the extended Higgs sector, we have some new heavy charged and neutral Higgs particles in addition to the light standard model-like Higgs. So what about flavor, fermions, fermion masses, and so on? So first of all, you have to introduce Yukawa couplings in order to generate quark masses. The most general Yukawa coupling that you can write down looks something like that up here. So you see that there's two couplings of left and right-handed quark fields to this bidoublet field phi. And the resulting quark masses, as you observe in nature, are then determined by a mixture of the two Yukawa couplings. So there's one mixture that gives you the up-type quark masses and another mixture that gives you the down-type quark masses, which then depends, again, on the ratio of the two VEFs in the bidoublet. And from this pattern of the two Yukawas, which both couple the Higgs to up and down fields, you will end up having flavor-changing heavy neutral Higgs couplings because the heavy Higgses couple with the different combinations of Yukawas than the light Higgs that generates the masses. And therefore, they will generate they will contribute to flavor-changing neutral current processes. And in addition, you also have these heavy charged Higgs particles that will also contribute to flavor-changing neutral currents at the loop level. Yep. The left-handed Higgs triplet is introduced merely in order to have a parity-symmetric particle content in your model. So if you aim to restore parity at some high-energy scale, you need those particles. Otherwise, just for the symmetry-breaking mechanism, you do not really need them. And in fact, we are not considering an explicitly parity-symmetric model, so we do not really need it. We just wrote it down in order to kind of keep the option to restore parity.
What if there's a fourth generation of quarks or leptons?
The fourth generation in the left-right model, I think.
Which they're looking for.
Yeah. I do not really see any
next,
problem.
Next model to consider.
No, I mean, I do not really see any fundamental problem with doing so. So, I mean, anomaly cancellation would still work. The structure is the same, just that the U covers become 4x4 matrices, so I do not see any fundamental problem with doing so. Okay, so so far for flavor-changing neutral currents effect from the Higgs sector. Then you also have new flavor-violating effects from the gauge sector because of this new gauge boson W prime and also because of its mixture with the standard model W. And these effects give you new right-handed charged currents, which are roughly given by this formula here. So the heavy W prime gives you order one a right-handed charged current coupling, while the standard model W gives you a right-handed coupling that is suppressed by this factor S times C times epsilon squared, where epsilon is the small parameter parametrizing the ratio of the Higgs vest. So what you also see is that both of these couplings are not proportional to the CKM matrix, but they are proportional to the right-handed analog of the CKM matrix, which I call here VR, which is a matrix like similar to the CKM matrix. Of course, it can have different, different values for the mixing angles. And also, instead of just one phase, as in the CKM matrix, now you do not have the freedom to remove phases, and you have six physical phases.
So as far as I remember, the usual story is that people try to use S parameter to zero, where you have S something, it's to avoid the, at least to localize flavor, you know, three-level flavor change.
Yeah, I mean,
the other part of the Higgs is the light Higgs also mediating the three-level temperature?
In the limit of S very small, it does not.
Okay.
And also, if you make S bigger than zero, it's still a higher order effect. So there's other effects. So the effects from the heavy Higgs are always bigger than from the light Higgs. And yeah, okay. Okay, so as I already mentioned, we do not study the parity symmetric case, but why is that? Well, first of all, what do we gain from studying the parity symmetric case? Well, the theory then becomes quite predictive because you know immediately that the gauge couplings of SU2L and SU2R have to be equal. And parity also tells you that the mixing angles of the right-handed matrix have to be equal to the mixing angles in the CKM matrix. So that is a very predictive framework, in particular for flavor phenomenology. Unfortunately, the predictions are not quite what you are happy about, because first of all, it tells you, so you have these really stringent data from kaon mixing, and those tell you that the right-handed W, so this W prime has to be at least 40 eV or heavier in order not to screw up your data there. And the second thing that you may realize it is that we wanted to solve the VUB problem, but since now the right-handed, so the VUBR, the right-handed analog of VUB is very small because it's just the same as the left-handed VUB, there's no way anymore to solve the VUB problem. And therefore, we decided not to assume a discrete left-right symmetry, which is usually taken to be parity, but you can also take charge conjugation symmetry, and the results are pretty similar. But we allow for a general, more general pattern having different gauge couplings and also different mixing matrices in order to have lower mass scales for the right-handed gauge bosons, and we also get a much richer flavor phenomenology. Okay, so let me come to the next part. So what about collider constraints on the left-right models? So we have already seen quite a lot of analysis from ATLAS and CMS, and let me now summarize the main points that apply to left-right models. And here, well, you know, we have these heavy charged, we have the heavy Higgs particles, but those are actually pretty heavy. We have the heavy C prime, but that's still at least a factor of two heavier than the W prime. So the main constraints are on W prime. So what are those? So first of all, let me come back to that measurement that I already showed you in the introduction. Basically, you can look for W prime in lepton plus missing energy events. And those events, if you just look up what CMS or S and also ATLAS quote, they give you a bound of roughly 2.5 TeV on the W prime mass. However, you should be really careful in just using this bound saying that's the end of the story, because those bounds, of course, only apply if the right-handed neutrino in which this W prime dominantly decays to is light enough to escape detection. And otherwise, if it has some Majorana mass, which it can get from the delta RF, then this bound simply does not apply. Instead, when the right-handed neutrino decays, it will decay into a lepton and a standard model W, which can then decay further. So that is the second point here on the list. Then you can look for dileptone and dijet events and for a resonance in that channel. And this has also been done. You can get then a 2D exclusion contour in the plane of right-handed W mass and heavy neutrino mass. And you see that for a pretty wide range of neutrino masses, the bound on the W prime mass is something like 1.6 TeV.
How happy is your Z prime compared to W prime?
It depends a bit on the parameters, on the ratio of gauge couplings, GL to GR. But it's always at least a factor of 2. It can be more. It's at least a factor of 2, yeah. It's just when you write down when you work out the electrophoric symmetry, you can put the waves into the kinetic term for the gauge fields and so on. Then you find this factor of 2. Okay, and then the third thing is if the right-handed neutrino is actually too heavy so that this decay channel is closed, then you may think, okay, what can the W prime now decay to? And it turns out that the dominant decay mode then is into right-handed quarks. So in that case, you can look at the digent resonance searches. And again, CMS quotes something like 1.5 TeV on the W prime mass. So in a nutshell, what we get is that the bounds on W prime, and in particular the surge channel, strongly depends on the heavy on the right-handed neutrino masses. And what I didn't yet really say, but you should really keep all this with a grain of salt, because all these searches use some simplifying assumptions. For instance, they assume that the left and right-handed gauge couplings are equal. Also, they usually assume that the decay channel they study is like 100% of the has 100% branching ratio or something like that. So before applying them to a concrete model, you should be a little bit more careful. Anyway, we've seen that all numbers on the previous slide were somewhere in the ballpark, 1.5 to 2 HeV. And since we did not feel too eager to perform a detailed collider analysis for the model, we said, okay, to be on the safe side, we require our W prime to be at least 2 TeV so that it's safe with those constraints. And in fact, as I will show you in a minute, once we choose a benchmark point which is in good agreement with the electrophoric position observables, we will actually end up having a benchmark point with a W prime mass of 2.6 TeV. So that's definitely safe with the collider constraints. Okay, so electrophoric position constraints. Those have been studied in big detail by C. Schmitz and Yu and Yuan in 2010. And their analysis has basically two major findings. So one of them is that they give you lower bounds on the Z prime mass and W prime mass from a full fit of about 40 electrophoric position observables. And while you see that the Z prime bound is rather strong, it's about 1.6 TeV, the W prime bound is very weak and only 300 GeV. Also, besides those bounds, they give you which observables actually yield the most stringent constraints. So if you want to constrain your, they did not quote the constraints on the Lagrangian parameters in the electrophoric sector, but they tell you what are the stringent constraints, which observables are really important for the model. And therefore, in order to constrain the electrophoric parameters, we decided to just perform a chi-squared fit of the most important constraints and then identify a set of electrophoric benchmark parameters that are in the best fit region. So since the model is not explicitly parity symmetric, I'm pretty sure that they had it in their fit. I'm not entirely sure what they found for that observable, but yeah, so that is definitely the list of observables that they quoted it as being the most stringent ones. But maybe we should go back to their paper and see what they say about Müller scattering.
So it's not as weak as
there is another experiment that's like 10 years ago. Compared to what I mean, it's made, they probably, all that I know is a similar sensitivity to the sine square thing, that would be the same model, but maybe it's for whatever reason.
Okay, so, well, we did a chi-square fit, and here let me just show you the result in the epsilon S plane. So recall epsilon is the ratio of V over the right-handed wave kappa R, and S is this parameter that gives you basically the ratios of the waves in the Higgs spiderplot. And you see that the best fit region is somewhere here, this dark blue area. And from this region, we decided to choose our benchmark parameters for our flavor analysis. So we set epsilon to be 3 times 10 to the minus 2. The ratio of gauge couplings GR over GL is 0.7. And for this parameter S, we decided to not fix it to a particular value a priori, but we allowed it somewhere in the range between 0.1 and 0.6. And the reason is that flavor observables are actually very dependent on the value of S, because the Higgs contributions are very dependent on S. And finally, another parameter that we need to fix is the heavy Higgs mass. And this mass we choose to be as large as possible, still in accordance with perturbativity constraints, because this mass is generated from the Higgs potential. And if you make some parameters in the Higgs potential too large, everything becomes non-perturbative, and you do not really understand things anymore. So what we took here is this 16 TeV divided by this function of S. And that is in order to have like a, so the mass is given by some parameter times kappa R times this function. And in order to have the parameter constant and as large as possible, the Higgs mass gets this S dependence. Oh, yep.
If I'm scaling it right, your the directly back to the W is like a fourth, sorry, a third, and so your W is a 2.4, so your electric bed is like your bed is like almost 10 TeV. So your quantum coupling is actually much harder.
I think the VEF was something around 5 TeV, if I remember correctly.
How can that be? W mass to electrolytic VEF is zero.
Yeah, but in so for the W mass, you have G times V divided by 2 or something.
Yeah.
And this divided by 2 is not there in the right-handed sector because it's a triplet value.
Well, but that just makes the problem worse. Your parting to your Higgs has to be used to get the mass of its size. Your bed is below 1 TeV. I mean, it doesn't matter if I rustle the analysis, but you said it's not perturbative.
Yeah. I mean, we really. So the quartic we choose there, I think we said it's something like 8. I mean, that is huge, of course. But if you look at the constraints from flavor physics, you will understand why we really pushed it to the bound.
No, it's okay. But I mean, at some level, if it's that large, it means that you have a cutoff at like 20 TeV. That's where your cutoff is. And that's there all hell breaks loose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Okay. Yep.
What happens to the standard electrolyte model with such a heavy Higgs?
This is not
the standard model Higgs. So the standard model like Higgs remains light. It's really it has standard model like properties. But you have additional Higgs particles because you have this Higgs spiderplot. There are several more degrees of freedom in there, and those are the ones which get this heavy mass.
So unitarity is still okay.
Yes. Okay, so let me turn to flavor in the model. So the first thing you can think of that you have to implement in order to constrain the model are the so-called tree-level constraints. constraints, which are the measurements that pretty directly constrain in the standard model the size of the CKM elements. Of course, here they constrain now a combination of CKM elements and elements of the right-handed mixing matrix. And because different decay channels are different, are sensitive to different combinations, so some of them are sensitive to the vector current, then you constrain this particular combination up there. If they, if the decay in question is sensitive to the axial current, then you constrain that particular combination up there. So you can go through this list of processes and you figure out what combination they are actually sensitive to. And that's stuff you can use to constrain your CKM matrix and right-handed mixing matrix at the same time. And I do not want to go into the details, just let you know that we impose these constraints at the true sigma level for our flavor analysis. The next thing you have to worry about are the constraints from particle-antiparticle mixing. So as you've probably seen many, many times before, these KK bar mixing and BB bar mixing in the standard model are generated by box diagrams, so by one loop processes where at, you have the W boson and the up-type quarks, mostly the top quark, running in the loop. And on the experimental side, these particle-antiparticle mixings are first of all characterized by the mass differences they generate, so delta MK for the kaon system and delta MD and delta MS for the B sub D and B sub S system. Those mass differences are CP conserving, they are well measured, they are in good agreement with the standard model. And you can also have CP violating observables. Here, let me quickly review them. So in the case of kaon mixing, you have this parameter epsilon k, which parametrizes the amount of indirect CP violation in k to pi pi decays. While in the B systems, so for B sub D, you have this time-dependent CP asymmetry called S psi k short, which measures CP violation in B sub D to J psi and k short decays. And for B sub S, it's pretty similar. Basically, the only thing that you change is the D quark for an S quark, and then you get end up with the time-dependent CP asymmetry S psi phi, which is measured in B sub S to J psi and phi. And for the B systems, let me also mention that there are also these semi-leptonic asymmetries, which are called ADSL and ASSL, respectively. And those are related to the dimuon charge asymmetry. We have, you've probably heard about this excitement from D0. Okay, so when you look at the constraints from particle-antiparticle mixing, on the standard model and on the determination of the CKM matrix, assuming the standard model being correct, you end up with this well-known global fit picture. So let me not go into the details what rho bar and eta bar precisely are defined to be. It's basically just a two-dimensional constraint on the CKM matrix. So what you expect if the standard model is correct is that all these constraints nicely intersect in one single point, and that's pretty much what you see here. This is the best fit region. It all seems to be working pretty well. And therefore, since all these processes are very suppressed in the standard model anyway, still the data agree very well. You get strong constraints on basically any kind of new physics beyond the standard model. And again, for this particle-antiparticle mixing processes, let me mention that we impose, again, all the constraints at the 2-sigma level. And since our analysis is already several months old and the data on S psi phi were not that precise then as they are now, we excluded S psi phi here and we treated it as a prediction. By now, you know that the LHCb measurement of S psi phi is already getting rather precise and it's still in good agreement. So I think maybe it would be more reasonable by now to also just impose it as a constraint. OK, so what about the new left-right contributions to these particle-antiparticle mixing processes? So the main contributions, as in many models, are coming now from these so-called left-right operators, which are operators that have both left- and right-handed quarks in the external states. Because these operators, the contributions of these operators get strong enhancement from renormalization group effects and also some chiral QCD enhancement when you go to the relevant matrix elements. So these left-right operators are the main players here in the left-right model as well. And to these leftoid operators, you have two main contributions. One of them is the tree-level exchanges of the new heavy Higgs particles, which have these flavor-violating couplings. And the second contributions are box diagrams, which look pretty much like the box diagrams in the standard model. Just like having two standard Ws in the loop, you now have one standard W and one of those heavy WR running in the loop, which has right-handed couplings here. So again, you end up with left and right-handed quarks in the external state. So you can calculate these diagrams pretty straightforwardly. And then you can parameterize the new physics contribution to the mixing amplitude in the following way. Basically, you get a prefactor that contains the relevant contribution of the CKM element and elements of the right-handed mixing matrix, just the VL and VR elements that are associated to these vertices. And it's actually the same combinations that enter here, times some factor Rij, which depends on the meson system that you look at. And this Rij contains basically, so either the loop integral for that diagram, or it's just the tree-level propagator for the Higgs. Plus, we also absorb all QCD effects in this Rij term. And with this structure, you can easily look at how big the Higgs contributions actually are relative to the new gauge boson contributions. And what you can see here, so notice that we've chosen here a logarithmic scale for the heavy Higgs mass, while the WR scale is given in the different colors. So if you look at the green line, which is the phenomenologically most relevant one, we put, so this is WR equals 2 TeV. Unfortunately, green is not very visible, but it's in between here, between the red and the black curve. So you see that even if you go to Higgs masses well above 10 TeV, so even if you go like to 20 TeV Higgs mass, you still get a very significant and usually dominant contribution to particle antimonical mixing from the heavy Higgses.
So what do you do with
the right-handed mixing? So if you just want to know about the relative size between the heavy Higgs and the W, it's the same combination of mixing elements that enter, so they just drop out by taking the ratio. So so the conclusion from looking at this plot is that the Higgs contributions are dominant even if you go for Higgs masses of about 20 TeV, and then you clearly get in trouble with perturbativity and the Landau pole and so on. So there's just no way to say, OK, these heavy Higgses are heavy, so I neglect them.
I remember that in epsilon, some k parameter for left, right, explicitly symmetric, you even have the strongest
Yeah. Because in the when you go for the explicitly left-right symmetric theories, then you have this. Then you have the mixing angles already given, and you know that the mixing between first and second generation is not so small. It's just the Capivo angle, and then the constraints are becoming stronger. Okay. So once we've identified the relevant contributions to delta F equal 2 processes, we have also implemented the tree-level constraints before. So now we are ready to perform some parameter scan and identify the regions for the right-handed mixing matrix that are still allowed by the observables that we have, even for W prime with like 2.6 TeV that we identified before. Okay, and you see here it's a three-dimensional figure. The three axes are the three mixing angles. So here this is the VUB right, this is VUS right, and VCB right. And you see that the parameter space is very constrained. So most of this cube is actually white, which means there is no parameter points that we found in our scan. And there's some very specific region only allowed still by the flavor data.
What are the colors?
The colors. The color basically represents the amount of fine tuning that you need in order to satisfy the constraints from particle antiparticle mixing. So, and by fine tuning, I assume you're, well, okay, let me go to that. Okay, so for the fine tuning measure, I guess everyone in this room has seen the Barbieri-Giudice measure of fine-tuning before, which basically measures the sensitivity of a given observable O to small variations in parameters pi. So that's just what this derivative structure here gives you. And then we decided, because we are not only studying one observable, but we have a bunch of flavor observables that can all be affected by fine-tuning, it's not to take the fine-tuning separately for every observable, but to sum over the fine-tunings that we obtain from the single observables.
Why not multiply?
It's kind of a matter of taste.
Well, not quite, right? Like, if it's a question of measures in some volume, you would actually multiply, not there. Right, like, if you're taking it as some sort of notion of how likely it is for this to be the case, you multiply, not adding.
I see.
With every tuning, it becomes less likely.
I see your point. It's definitely worth thinking about. Okay, but anyway, what we did is summing over all the fine tunings, and I think I forgot a 1 over number of observables here, but that doesn't really matter that much. So that's our measure of fine tuning that we used, and that's the color code in the plot.
So you, I guess if I say, suppose you have sort of percent fine tuning, but then your sum goes like to 1,000, right?
Yeah.
And then when you get to order 1,
yeah, I mean, I agree that there's always some arbitrariness in how you define the fine-tuning and how you always miss a certain notion that you have for fine-tuning. And I agree that I was also worried for a while that if you just add more observables and more observables, and this number certainly, I mean, once you put the 1 over n normalization in there, then the number becomes less and less significant. But the point is that all the observables that we include are actually fine-tuned in some corner of parameter space. And we wanted to make a difference, like, so you can imagine that for one parameter poise, you have a relatively large fine-tuning in, say, epsilon k, but all the other observables are perfectly fine. And for another point, maybe the fine-tuning in epsilon k is a little bit less, but then you have also some not insignificant fine-tuning in delta mk or in B sub D mixing or wherever. And well, it's kind of a matter of taste what is more natural. And anyway, what I would like to add is that this whole Barbieri-Giudice measure, by definition, is not sensitive to choosing, for instance, the mixing angles just to be very small, because it's not sensitive to just accidentally small parameters. It's only sensitive to cancellations between, like, fine-tunes cancellations between different contributions. And I haven't yet seen any fine-tuning measure that can capture all these different things of what you just have a notion of this is fine-tuned, can actually quantify it. Okay. So, yeah. So once you look at the fine-tuning color code as well, you see that the least fine-tuned region is definitely down here, where all the mixing angles are relatively small. But you also identify that there are not so fine-tuned points up there for large VCB, right? So this is a very interesting pattern, because it's very different from the CKM matrix, where all the mixing angles are small. Here you can also have like kind of an inverted scenario, where the first two, so the 1-2 mixing is relatively small, the 2-3 mixing is, the 1-3 mixing is relatively small, but the 2-3 mixing can actually be very large. And just to give you some numbers, this is a constraint that we found by assuming that this modified fine-tuning measure is smaller than 10. Okay. So the next step is studying the S-dependence of our constraints. So from this figure, this is basically now a two-dimensional cut through the cube that you've just seen before. It's now the VUB, right, versus, it's not a cut, it's a projection. So VUB right versus VCB right. Again, you see that the allowed regions are very non-generic. There are strong correlations between the various elements of the right-handed mixing matrix. And also what you see here, the color code represents the value of S. You see that once you go to larger and larger values of S, so you go from blue to red, the allowed regions of parameter space shrink significantly because mostly the Higgs contributions are becoming more and more important and stronger and more dangerous. So yeah, just to add that in this plot, we have put the points with small s behind the plots with big s. So wherever you see something red here, there, you can be sure that there's also a blue point behind it. Okay. So once you've identified the allowed regions of parameter space for the right-handed mixing matrix, you can ask what you learned from those in terms of other observables that are not yet well constrained. And well, in order to do that, we first of all look at the relative size of left-right effects in particle-antiparticle mixing, so relative to the standard model. So you've seen that this left-right operator was always governed by this combination of left-handed and right-handed mixing matrix elements. And if you just put left everywhere, it's just the usual combination of CKM elements that you have in the standard model. You can then easily work out that this ratio is the same as just having like some right-right contribution divided by the CKM contribution. And once you stare at it for another second, you realize that this same contribution will then be also relevant for rare K and BDKs, which we haven't yet explicitly calculated. But already from this pattern, you can start estimating the effects in rare K and BDKs and see which observables are potentially interesting. So here we have this ratio of the right-handed combination of mixing elements divided by the left-handed combination, so by the standard model combination. This axis is for the Kaon system. This axis here is the B sub D system. And the vertical axis is the B sub S system. And when you compare the numbers on the axis, you clearly see that the largest effects are possible in the Kaon system. So you see factors of 100, 200 or something of enhancements of the right-handed combination of mixing elements versus the CKM elements. And the effects are much smaller in B sub S, where the axis only goes to 10 here, and even smaller in B sub D, where we only show points up to like 1.5 or so. So the largest effects from this figure are certainly to be expected in rare Kaon decays. However, again, look at the color code. This is, again, the fine-tuning measure that we defined before. You do not see anything that is blue or even dark blue in here. So large effects in Kaon decays are definitely coming with a large fine-tuning in KK bar mixing and mainly in epsilon K, because that's the observable that, in most cases, dominates the fine-tuning measure. Not always, but in most cases. OK, so let me turn to CP violation, B sub S mixing, because there has been a lot of excitement about this in recent years. So first of all, let me mention that this error band on S-Psi Phi is not up to date. The error band is becoming much smaller and much closer to the standard model. So you have like only a 0.1 uncertainty or something like this by now from the Morion data from LHCb. And well, since we did not include this constraint in our analysis, but we scanned over all possibilities, and we found that in principle, the left-right model can accommodate any CP phase in B sub S mixing. That's what you see here by the blue band. It can, of course, also accommodate standard model-like phases. And another thing that you see here is that you also include the D0 data on this semi-leptonic asymmetry in the plot. This band is somewhere down here, which means that the data are, of course, very hard to accommodate. But this is not a fault of the left-right model. It's a fault of basically any new physics model, because this correlation between the two CP asymmetries is pretty model independent. And so you cannot blame the left-right model for not being able to do that. I think that most likely there's really some problem with the D0 experiment in that case. Okay, so let me turn to another decay trial, which is very interesting because it puts many interesting constraints on new physics models, which are the decays B to S gamma and also B to D gamma. So we calculated those decays as well. And what we find is that here again, you have a very strong dependence on this parameter S in the Higgs potential. So the color here shows again different values of S, where in this case we have put the small s values in front so that you see them. And here you find that the effects in B to S gamma and B to D gamma are much smaller when you go to small values of S. So for small values of S of like 0.1, 0.2, you remain very close to the standard model prediction. And the effect only becomes important when you go to values of S which are larger than about 0.5. And this is, again, because you have this enhancement of the charge Higgs contribution to B to S gamma. Yeah, you have. Yes, I agree. So there's two contributions. The one is the one from the charge ticks running in the loop, and the other one is the one that you mentioned, where you have just the standard model W pick up its right-handed coupling so that you do not need anymore the chirality flip on the external V line. So in principle, the effect is important. However, the mixing between the W and this WR is suppressed by S times C times epsilon squared. So S is, again, the small parameter. C is basically the square root of 1 minus S squared. And epsilon is also small. And therefore, the contribution from the W loops turns out to be well inside the bounds. OK, so another thing that you can look at is the bound on the heavy Higgs mass. And as we already discussed, you cannot make the heavy Higgs masses arbitrarily large, because then you run into trouble with perturbativity and with the Landau pole in your theory. It can certainly be discussed on how where you actually put the bound. It also depends on where you are happy with having a Landau pole or not. But you cannot go to something like 100 TeV or whatever in order to just decouple the heavy Higgses. On the other hand, the flavor data, because they are so much affected by the heavy Higgses, certainly give you a lower constraint on the Higgs mass. And this is something that we try to determine by our parameter scan. So also, this bound should not be taken as a completely strict line, because with a parameter scan, you can always miss a tiny little portion of parameter space because your algorithm just didn't go there in a random scan. But still, what we found is that below this line, we didn't find any points that were allowed by the delta F equal 2 and B to S gamma constraints. So you see that although generically you want to have the heavy Higgses pretty heavy, you can still, if S is small, you can still go for heavy Higgses of masses like 2 to 3 TeV. But then the right-handed mixing matrix has to be very hierarchical and very close to the unit matrix in order to achieve that. OK, then let me come to my motivation for the whole study, the VUB problem. So remember, we had this inconsistency in the determination of the element VUB from various decay channels. And in order to solve this inconsistency, we need a right-handed current. So the right-handed current is basically given by this mixing between right-handed W and standard W, which is SC times epsilon squared, times the VUB element of the right-handed matrix. And the size of the effect that we need is roughly 6 times 10 to the minus 4. So this is shown here in the figure. The number we want to have is this thick black dotted line, 6 times 10 to the minus 4. On the vertical axis, you have the size of the effects. Here, we show it as a function of S again. And the various lines here are the upper bounds, what we found in our parameter scan. So how far can you possibly go? So if you just take all points in our parameter scan that fulfill all the constraints, you end up with the black line as upper bound. So you see you can at least get close to what we need in order to solve the VUB problem, but still not quite. So there's still some tension remaining. However, if you then ask, OK, I do not want to just have some parameter point, but I want to actually have something like a natural solution, i.e. not too large a fine-tuning, then the thing looks pretty different. Because so if you go for fine-tuning smaller than about 10, what people usually like to have, something like 10% fine-tuning at most, then you end up with the green line, and you see that you are way below what you want to have. So notice that this is a logarithmic axis, so it's really like almost two orders of magnitude below where you want to go. And even if you are a bit more bit more agnostic about fine-tuning and say, OK, 1% fine-tuning is OK, then you end up with the blue line. And there is still a gap of a factor of 3 or so missing in order to solve the VUB problem. So unfortunately, in the model under consideration, the delta F equal 2 constraints preclude the solution of the VUB problem, in particular if you want to have low fine-tuning. So let me come to my summary. I hope I've shown you that in the left-right model, there are strong constraints for meson-anti-meson mixing, and in particular, the CP-violating parameter in KK-bar mixing called epsilon K. We have seen that the delta F equal 2 effects are, delta F equal 2 observables are dominated in left-right models by the tree-level exchanges of the heavy Higgs particles. And we have also seen that in order to satisfy the constraints, you need a very hierarchical structure for the right-handed mixing matrix. However, still, the left-right model that we have studied can be made consistent with the electroweak precision and flavor constraints for low W prime masses that are still well in the reach of the LHC. However, the VUB problem in this model cannot be solved. Thank you.
In the standard model, a weak neutral current is constructed from W A B, W A, the hypercharge weak, and sine theta. Now you have another W in the right hand. So this influences how the weak current is constructed.
You're asking for the effects of the W prime to the Fermi, so to GF, so mu and decay, or, sorry, can you repeat it? I think I didn't quite get what you were saying.
Well, presumably, the flavor changing stuff comes from the structure of the weak neutral current. It's permitted. A new one.
Are you worried about the electroweak precision data?
Yeah.
So that's what the one of our first slides. This is not their work.
Just assume it's the same site.
No, they actually went through all the constraints.
Yeah, they did a full fit of all these 40 electroweak precision observables, the lab 2 and everything, yeah.
So what's your favorite solution for the problem if this one doesn't?
So the problem is, I think that the only way to solve the VUB problem is really right-handed currents. At least I don't see anything else other than we do not really understand what's going on with QCD and also with the B. So as you said, the B to pi is maybe not so well understood. So maybe even if you ignore that, but still you have the tension between inclusive and B to tau nu. But then maybe we do not understand the B decay constant so well. So maybe that's off. So that could solve it. But other than that, so once
even
we trust
value
our.
Is much harder, it's preventable.
Yeah, true. There could also be some flaw in the measurement. So, but if you just take the values for the VUB problem as they are and say, I believe in them, then I think the only way to solve it is really the presence of right-handed currents. And then you might think, OK, what can you do here? Because, so what you need for the solution of the VUB problem is basically the mixing of your new W right with the standard model W. But the real problems here are caused mainly by the Higgs sector. So you can still try to extend the Higgs sector, include some symmetry or whatever in order to avoid the constraints from mainly KK bar mixing. And then I think it should be doable.
How conclusive is this UV experiment? Is it definitely a problem?
Sigma.
Yeah, it's something like 2 sigma. So maybe it's just statistical.
Two
you never know.
So it could just go away from that.
It could go away.
Sure, it could.
No, there are people who are saying that you seek the new paradigm. We don't get the new problems.
2 sigma doesn't cut.
Sure.
No.
But the problem is if two sigma doesn't stall, we don't have anything to stare at.
Oh, also two sigma is a motivation, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Some.
And I mean, it's not only a two sigma discrepancy between two numbers, but you have the three numbers that are like off from each other. So it looks, you can take it as a motivation to look for a pattern. Let's say it like that.
Okay, so that's thank Monique once again.